I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we begin today with the sounds of a tragic and distressing experience that's become far too common for so many in our country.
911, what is the address of your emergency? Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
I don't know. I found a kid overdose. I had some Narcan in my car, so I tried giving it to him, but it didn't work. He's on the side of the railroad tracks.
Second 40, kick in, I got another bottle right here.
Go, go.
Allie?
Yeah.
Here,
give him
this.
Okay.
Here, give him the one Narcan.
Okay.
Okay.
Three hits of it so far.
Okay. We gave him 3 hits of Narcan. I don't know the kid. I don't know who he is. I don't know how old he is.
This is what it sounds like to try to save the life of someone who's overdosing on an opioid. And this particular experience comes from the documentary series Dope Sick Nation by Vice TV. But harrowing moments just like this one have become part of daily life in rural communities, small towns, and big cities. According to the CDC, more than 850,000 people have died from drug overdoses in America during the past 2 decades. And the numbers have increased sharply in recent years. In 2019, overdoses claimed nearly 71,000 lives. And during the first year of the pandemic, that number rose to 100,000 deaths. Synthetic opioids are driving these brutal numbers, accounting for nearly 3/4 of all fatal overdoses. The opioid emergency is a human catastrophe, but it's also an economic market, responding to supply, demand, innovation, and changing conditions. Now, if you're a little rusty on your Econ 101, just remember that in general, low supply and high demand makes prices rise, whereas plentiful supply and steady demand should make prices fall. But in the opioid market, something else seems to be at play. Let's start with the price of heroin. In the early 80s, a gram of pure heroin cost just over $2,000. Today, the same amount costs about $500. And if you're looking to get a high, buying a bag of heroin will run you just $5. I mean, it's easy to spend twice that much for a daily hit of Starbucks. So I hope you're asking, but wait, what? How could there be such a dramatic price decrease when demand is so high? With more people using, shouldn't heroin cost more? Well, the answer to that is innovation. Heroin is much cheaper today because it is now much cheaper to make. In 1985, producing heroin meant waiting for poppies to grow, harvesting and processing them, then transporting the product across international borders. Today, with a relatively simple setup and a combination of widely available chemicals, you can create cheap, powerful, synthetic opioids, namely fentanyl. And fentanyl just might be the one part of the American supply chain that has not broken in the pandemic. Demand for opioids is high, but the supply of cheap, potent, synthetic fentanyl has kept pace with the demand, so prices are low. But there is one rapidly rising cost in this market: the price of naloxone. This is not a drug used to get high. This is a drug used to save lives. And you probably know naloxone by its common brand name, Narcan. Now, naloxone is miraculously effective at reversing the effects of an overdose. And when administered swiftly, it nearly always prevents death. And because naloxone has been FDA approved since 1971, it's now off patent. It should be cheap. 10 years ago, it was. You could get a life-saving single dose of naloxone for about $1. Prices are very different today. Even before the pandemic, the New England Journal of Medicine reported price increases of 100 to 500% depending on the formulation and method of delivery. And last week, reporting from The Guardian detailed a continued spike in naloxone prices. In other words, if you want to make big profits in today's opioid market, you're much better off selling naloxone than selling heroin. For more on this, let's talk with Melody Schreiber, a contributor to The Guardian US and editor of the book, What We Didn't Expect, Personal Stories About Premature Birth. Melody, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Dr. Navarun Dasgupta, Senior Scientist and Innovation Fellow at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Dr. Dasgupta, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to begin with you, Dr. Dasgupta. What is naloxone, or Narcan, as I think many of us sort of commonly know it?
So someone overdosing on strong pain meds like heroin will go still like they're falling asleep. These drugs act on the part of the brain that controls the will to breathe, like our most fundamental companion from birth. The drug that is naloxone is something that I call the anti-funeral drug. It helps people stay alive and prevent overdoses. The antidote kicks heroin out of the brain, restoring the desire to breathe instantly. When I've given it, people were breathing again in 2 minutes. If you give it to someone once by mistake, it doesn't do any additional harm. It's as close to a miracle drug as you can get. Frontline public health workers have been distributing it to people who use drugs since 1996. They've given out more than 6 million doses. Last year, 1.3 million doses alone. We can document that there are hundreds of thousands of people alive today because of this life-saving intervention. It's the anti-funeral drug.
All right. I want to take one more beat on this so that I understand, because you were talking about healthcare professionals and frontline workers giving it to those who are experiencing overdoses since the 90s, but it's been around since the 70s. What was it initially created for? What was the initial sort of on-label purpose?
So it was initially discovered by someone named Jack Fishman, who was trying to find a way to have less constipation from opioids. It turned out that this medicine actually works even better at reversing the overdose and letting people breathe again. So for the first decade or two, it was used mostly in the operating room for helping anesthesiologists bring people back to consciousness after surgery. It was eventually after that emergency personnel started using it in the hospitals, and then eventually it came out into ambulances as well.
Got it. Thank you. Now, Melody, I was talking in the introduction about this sort of bizarre reality where the price of things like heroin has dropped precipitously over the same period, sort of since the mid-1980s, but that now the price of naloxone is absolutely skyrocketing. I've got some theories about it, but you're the researcher here. Help me to understand in your reporting why these prices are soaring.
Well, so first of all, I know prices went up, I think you mentioned in the intro at the before the pandemic. Right now, the company that makes Narcan says that they actually haven't raised the price since they introduced it to the market. It came in high because of the way that it's administered. But the problem is the companies making more affordable naloxone have had some manufacturing issues. So the people who need it the most are not able to access an affordable version of the drug. They have to go by the brand name, and that's 30 times higher than what they've been paying.
And Melody, is that primarily about the route of delivery, or is there actually something different about the Narcan brand name versus the generic naloxones?
Narcan uses kind of an inhaler. You put it in your nose, and that's a different delivery than injectable naloxone. But I mean, it's a pretty basic nasal spray, essentially.
Dr. Dasgupta, do you want to weigh in on the formulation of the generic versus the name brand here?
Sure. So part of what complicates the simple supply and demand picture is that we don't really have a free market for naloxone in the United States. Instead, we have this Byzantine system where money from the federal government goes to states through an arcane formula. Legislatures and health departments get involved and pick a couple of programs in each state to fund. The on-the-ground programs get the money, then they need a doctor to write a prescription. Then corporate compliance officers require the doctor to get an affidavit for that prescription. The programs place an order with one medical supply company, then have to purchase it from a second distributor, and then finally it goes back to the program to distribute. So every step along this way is a reason for someone to say no. And because of this process, what should be $2.50 to make a naloxone kit ends up not being available to all the programs that can do the last mile delivery and get the drug to where it needs to go.
Now, Melody, as part of this sort of big story of sort of how it goes from production to actually saving lives, right, being the anti-funeral drug on the ground for folks, tell me about the OSNN.
The OSNN has a buyer's club to help harm reduction groups purchase naloxone with an agreement with Pfizer, and I believe with agreements with other pharmaceutical companies, generics, even the company that makes Narcan. So the OSNN helped negotiate this deal with Pfizer in 2012 to purchase naloxone at a greatly reduced price. Dr. Kuduskup, to tell me what I'm getting wrong here.
Sure. You got that pretty much right. So in 2012, Dan Bigg and I negotiated this deal with Pfizer to get us very affordable naloxone to the 110 programs that are responsible for reaching the most difficult to reach populations, the programs that have the most trust with the communities that need the naloxone the most. The Buyers Club facilitates those contracts. And so for the last decade, we've only had Pfizer as our supplier. So in April of this year, Pfizer had a manufacturing problem at the one factory in the country where they used to make naloxone. That essentially created a shortage of the cheap, affordable naloxone that these programs had been relying on and had used to buy about 6 million doses of naloxone. So we ended up with having to find other sources of naloxone. The company that makes nasal Narcan, the brand name, the $75 product, when we talked to them, they literally laughed at us and told us not to put the request in writing. So we went looking for other companies who would be more compassionate. And in doing so, we found one company that already made a generic version of the liquid injectable naloxone. And they have given us 50,000 doses for free, and we've distributed them already in 2 weeks. And we're working with them to manufacture a few hundred thousand doses more at a greatly discounted price that programs can actually afford, not the $75 nasal spray.
So what does this look like, Melody, on the ground with harm reduction groups? What do these rising prices mean for them?
To put it quite simply, as one source did, if something costs 30 times more than it did before, that means that you're saving one life instead of 30 lives. I mean, that's as simple and basic as you get it. Because of these price issues, more people are dying, thousands more people.
Is this a carve-out moment? Is this something surprising within pharmaceuticals and that market in general? Or do we typically see, I mean, I'm just saying, I was in the hospital with my mother, who is, in her 70s during the pandemic. She was in for another reason. But I mean, suddenly Tylenol in the hospital costs much, much more. So I'm wondering, if sort of soaring prices is normal or if there's something specific here about this drug.
So there is something very specific here that's happening that hasn't really been acknowledged. And that's the difference in regulation between what's happening at the federal level versus the state level. On the state level, naloxone is basically treated as over-the-counter. State legislatures and through standing orders and other kind of directives have made it so that naloxone can be distributed by anyone and doesn't carry the same penalties as other prescription drugs. Now, on the federal level, on the national level, FDA still considers this a prescription drug. So you have to have a single physician for every order of naloxone that each of these programs place. What happens is that the corporate compliance officers at the pharmaceutical companies, at the pharmaceutical distributors, are compelled to treat this like a prescription drug and keep it locked away in that pharmaceutical system. This is so acute. You asked about the inventors of naloxone. So Dr. Fishman, who invented naloxone, his stepson died of a heroin overdose because, in part, he could not get access to the medication he invented to save that life because it was a prescription drug. We're at this point where the prescription requirement on a federal level is the root of all evil when it comes to getting more naloxone out to where it needs to go. Until we can get parity and resolution between the way states want this medicine to be used and the way that FDA says it should be used, that's the key missing link, in addition to funding, that will unlock naloxone to get it out to the places that are the most hardest hit.
Okay, Dr. Dasgupta, thank you. So that is so helpful to understand that, and particularly in connection, Melody, with what you were saying around the steps the federal government can take. But again, let me just try to understand this. If I walk into my local pharmacy, how do I know if I'm operating at the state or the federal level?
Depends on the mood of the pharmacist. In North Carolina, for example, you can go into a pharmacy and request it. You may end up getting the nasal spray, which costs $75. You may have a copay. One of the things that happens with when you go and purchase it in a pharmacy is that there can be downstream consequences for your health finances. So we had a physician who works with us who had purchased naloxone at a pharmacy because it was something he wanted to do, wanted to have on hand. When he went to get life insurance after the birth of his child, he got penalized for having purchased naloxone in the pharmacy because it was part of, you know, a list of flagged drugs that increase life insurance rates. So it's not as simple as putting more of this on retail pharmacy shelves. The real solution is getting this into the hands of the programs and people who have the most trust with the communities that are hardest hit by the overdose problem. And these are mostly, you know, folks who are working with historically marginalized people, people coming out of prisons, people living in rural Appalachia, people who these programs that are run by and serving populations of color. And so that's really who we need to be prioritizing right now in the middle of this crisis, and not trying to send more naloxone onto pharmacy shelves, not trying to get more cops to carry naloxone, and not trying to stock every school and library with naloxone. Right now, we need to focus on the last mile.
Melody, can you weigh in here as well? It's getting clearer sort of the ways that the federal government could really be a problem solver here. Is that likely to happen?
In the CARES Act funding, there was the possibility of making these medications over the counter, and medications like naloxone could qualify in this program, and that would make it a lot easier for harm reduction groups to access the medication. So far, the FDA has used it for things like ingrown toenails and wart removers, but you know, there's the option here to put it toward maximum use for saving lives. There are also other regulatory ways the FDA could compel the manufacturing of this of these drugs. You could use the Defense Production Act, which you can invoke pretty much anytime there's a national security crisis. And with a 30% rise in overdose deaths in the first year of the pandemic, that sounds like a crisis to me. And so, you know, there are different regulatory avenues for making this more widely available, you know, from production to, as Dr. Dasgupta says, the last mile here of delivering to the people who are at most risk of dying from an overdose, which is easily preventable. It could be affordable.
Dr. Dasgupta, I will let you kind of have the last word on this. Are there members of Congress, or are there officials operating, you know, at the federal level within the FDA and other sources who are sort of carrying this, who are pushing for exactly the kinds of changes that you say can make such a big difference?
We've had really good response from the U.S. senators who we've spoken to, and we have more meetings lined up. The question isn't if we should do this, it's how. Let's figure out the mechanics. I think this is a classic situation when there is discrepancy between federal law or federal regulation and state level medical practice, that Congress is really the one that needs to step in, because FDA is tightly bound by their rules that they have to follow. So I think if Congress could pass a law that would authorize the cheap, generic, liquid injectable form of naloxone to be without a prescription requirement, that would be the single greatest thing that would help us to prevent deaths in the immediate future.
Dr. Nabarun Dasgupta is Innovation Fellow and Senior Scientist at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. And Melody Schreiber is a contributor to The Guardian US. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We've been discussing the life-saving drug, naloxone, and we wanted to know if you have had personal experiences where it was necessary for you to use this drug. Here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Neil from Ohio. I'm a former paramedic, and yes, I have used Narcan on many occasions. The interesting thing is it generally acts quickly, and the person receiving it generally responds badly. They're really mad when you take their eye away.
Hi, this is Cherie from Springfield, Oregon. In regards to Narcan, it's a new thing, you know, and I'm clean and sober for like 40 years, but in the day, I saw someone go down and die when they didn't have Narcan.
This is Pete from Oakland. I'll never forget this. Was walking to a meeting in San Francisco, saw an unhoused person lying on the ground, struggling, eyes rolling back, biting their tongue. And then saw the bouncer from the bar next door. Then I stopped, checked that the person was breathing, tried to assess how to respond, and looked over to the bouncer next door, and they calmly walked over and said, "Oh, yep, we got Narcan on hand. All of our staff are trained. Let me take it from here." And administered the Narcan. The person woke up. They may have saved that person's life that night. Everybody should have it. It's really important.
I had to use some Narcan one time as a security guard in a mall, and I was the first on the scene as I was flagged down by some people who saw some people who were acting weird, and I was talking to them, and before I knew it, they had both fallen down in the middle of the food court, and I was waiting for more backup to arrive. Basically, they had a low pulse, and we knew that they were on some kind of drug, but they hadn't been able to tell us, as they were kind of out of it before they slipped out of consciousness. We were able to get the fire department on the way, and as they were there, myself and the other security guards went through the man's, one of the men's backpacks, and we found one of the Narcan nasal sprays, and we administered it to the man to whom the backpack belonged. By that time, the paramedics had basically shown up, and they rushed the men into an ambulance and off to the hospital. I kind of regret not going to the hospital afterwards to make sure that they were all right.
My name is Deborah, and I am calling from Columbia, South Carolina. My family resides in northwestern Ohio, and they have been affected by the opioid epidemic right now. My niece's husband is in the hospital right now fighting COVID, also fighting addiction, hepatitis C, you name it, and he's not even 40 years old. He's leaving behind a 9-year-old daughter and, of course, my niece, and she has two other children that are 3 and, like, 1. And now they're onto the fentanyl. We were hoping this was going away, but due to alcoholism as well, it's hard to fight all of these addictions. It really has affected everyone in my family.
Thanks so much for sharing your stories with us. We always want to hear from you. So never hesitate to give us a call at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or find us on social media at The Takeaway and share your stories with us there. This month marks the release of the new Hulu miniseries, Dope Sick. Based on a book by the same name by journalist Beth Macy, Dope Sick details how the Sackler family and their company, Purdue Pharma, made billions while initiating a massive drug epidemic. Refusing to sensationalize the crisis, the Dope Sick miniseries connects this corporate greed with stories of those directly harmed by it.
Our initial rollout will be focused on southwestern Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and rural Maine. And do you know why? Anyone?
They're mining, farming, logging centers, places where folks get injured doing labor-intensive jobs.
Correct. These people are in pain. They have hard lives, and we have the cure. So we are sending you all into the wild to flip these country doctors from Percocet and Vicodin to OxyContin.
With me now is Danny Strong, creator, showrunner, and director of Dope Sick. Thanks for being here, Danny.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk to me about why the decision to tackle so many different pieces all at once?
Well, because it's such a complicated, dynamic, and multifaceted issue that to tell just one story to me didn't feel like that's the truth or the essence of the opioid crisis. There's so many different elements. There's the lies of Purdue Pharma, its victims. There's also these investigations that occurred. The U.S. attorney, John Brownlee, out of Western Virginia, the DEA in 2000 to 2002 had active investigations into Purdue Pharma. And I thought by telling those stories as well, you could really shine a spotlight on the actual crimes that Purdue committed. And then ultimately, where the U.S. attorney case and where the DEA investigations went tie into one of the bigger issues that created the opioid crisis, which is the revolving door, which is moneyed influence in our government institutions and how they can be influenced to such an extent that a company like Purdue Pharma was able to flourish even after OxyContin and become famous.
For all its complexity and the fact that it does not simply flatten people into good guys and bad guys, there are at least a couple of clear villains in this portrayal. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of your decisions about how to represent those at the very top of Purdue Pharma?
The company is micromanaged by the Sackler family. Now, for years, they denied that. And they said, oh, we're passive participants. We're just on the board. Other people are making decisions. And then all their emails started coming out in discovery and all the attorney general cases against them. And lo and behold, that was, like everything else that ties into Purdue Pharma, a lie. So I wanted to show who was making these decisions. And it's been very well documented at this point in numerous books by incredibly gifted journalists, including Beth Macy and Patrick Radin Keefe, Barry Meyer, Gerald Posner, the list goes on and on, that Richard Sackler was the godfather who was managing the production and launch and distribution of OxyContin. He was the person overseeing this. We had to portray him as a character in the show. Then it gets a little more complicated because he's perceived in such a negative light. How can I multidimensionalize him? So then I was able to interview people, some people that knew him, and they disliked him more than the activists. I mean, it was very difficult to find anyone to say anything nice about Richard Sackler. And clearly this is a complicated individual, an individual that puts people off even when he's in the company of them. But I still felt like, well, there's got to be something more to this than greed. Clearly greed is a huge motivation, but what else is there? What else is motivating him? So I went on a deep dive to try to sort of crack this mystery of what's really happening with Richard Sackler. And I feel like, yes, it's certainly, I can totally see how it's perceived as a villainous portrayal. What that company did was absolutely awful, that he was micromanaging. At the same time, I do think there are dimensions to it that are interesting, that are human, that go deeper than I think people would have expected. Even people that I interviewed that knew him would have expected in what we were able to achieve in the show.
My favorite moment so far, I'm only four episodes in, but my favorite moment so far is actually your portrayal of FBI Director James Comey, who seems to be a bit confused about the language of the Purdue family and thinks that his investigators are looking at chicken.
Yeah, so this actually happened early in the investigation. The U.S. Attorney John Brownlee and his assistant U.S. attorneys on the case, Randy Ramsire and Rick Mountcastle, were told they had to come to Washington, D.C. to meet with the Deputy Attorney General to discuss the case. So obviously they were immediately concerned. The case, it was very early in the process. And they thought, wow, is the Deputy Attorney General, James Comey, which is what he was at the time, is he going to shut us down before we even began? So they go to Washington, D.C., and right out of the gate, Comey says, why are you investigating the chicken guy? And there's obviously this confusion. And then it became apparent that he thought that they were investigating Frank Purdue of Purdue Farms, not Purdue Pharma. So once they cleared that up, he said, we'll go make your case. So they were off to the races once again. But yeah, very strange.
Danny, I'm just so happy that story is true. As I watched it, I thought, did they make this up? So I'm just, no. I'm so pleased. I mean, both pleased and horrified to know that that story is true.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very, very strange. One of the strange events of the opioid crisis.
So that was sort of a, you know, that's maybe kind of a lighthearted intervention. But the show is really at times quite tragic. But I think more than anything, I might describe it as, and we've talked about this on the Takeaway before, as being sincere. Like, particularly the character of the lead doctor, who is a small town doctor in a coal mining community, just feels like a sincere, good guy who was trying to do his best and was, you know, to serve a community that is typically underserved, and yet ended up having and doing great harm to that same community.
Yeah, well, I was really fascinated and just personally wanted to know, how did this happen on the ground? When you look at these events, you know, I started researching this in 2018, the idea that they could say an opioid was practically non-addictive, that less than 1% of people got addicted, that they were using these phrases like pseudo-addiction, which meant addiction didn't really exist. They seem absurd when you look back at it through a 2018 lens. So I wanted to know, so how did that happen? How did these doctors, how did these people that went to medical school essentially fall for this con, for this lie? So I interviewed multiple doctors, and it was really fascinating talking to them. There's basically three different doctors that Dr. Phoenix is directly inspired by. One of them, Dr. Stephen Lloyd, he just gave an interview in which he referred to the show as, quote, balls on accurate. So I thought, well, that's pretty
okay.
good.
You know,
I think we did pretty good there. But so yes, you know, there obviously were doctors that took advantage of the fact that it was so addictive, and they opened pill mills, and they were just trying to obviously make as much money in as dark and as you know, corrupt a way as they could. But that's not the story of all of the doctors that prescribed this medication. I think that's a much smaller percentage of the doctors. I think most of the doctors thought, oh, this is a great new drug that is way less addictive than other opioids, or so they thought. So I'm going to prescribe it to my patients in pain. And I wanted to know, how did that happen? And so we see it through the character of Dr. Phoenix and his journey.
All right. So, Danny, here's my one irritation as I watched. And here was all this humanity, and particularly the humanity of those who became addicted, right, who were literally just looking for pain relief, went to doctors they trusted. Doctors who they trusted then prescribed something because they had been largely lied to. I gotta say, I walked away feeling like I still haven't seen this level of complexity and humanity in the portrayal of Black urban drug users. And it's less a critique of DopeSick itself and more of wondering why we have now this beautiful story, but where it is truly focused on vastly predominantly white working class communities. And I think so many of the negative portrayals and assumptions that we have about people of color who use drugs remain.
Yeah, well, look, I don't disagree with you at all. And in the case of DopeSick and the opioid crisis, you know, that was a very much targeted in these white rural communities, particularly in these early stages. And then there's also a theory that institutional racism was actually helpful in that doctors weren't prescribing OxyContin to their Black patients out of this sort of racist bias that they couldn't take it or that they would abuse it. And so it's sort of a Patrick Radin Keefe in the book Empire of Pain calls it a rare example in which institutional racism was actually helpful. Now, in what you're talking about, like I said, I completely agree with you. And so much of what we were trying to do with this show was also redefine sort of the stereotype of addiction, the understanding of addiction, particularly an opioid addiction in which your brain chemistry has been changed. And I would encourage filmmakers of all colors to do exactly what you just said, which is, you know, tell this story in the Black community as well, because I think for a long time, addiction has been portrayed as exactly as how you said it. But I think addiction has been portrayed in that way across the board. And that was certainly a motivation for how we did it in this show. And it was very important to Beth Macy in particular, who wrote the book Dope Sick, because that's so much of what the core of her book is about.
So can I ask, and feel free to punt this question if you want to, but again, the humanity, the complexity, I'm wondering if you have personal stories here, if you are connected to this crisis in a way that gave you entry, or if this is a story that any of us, whether we are directly connected to this crisis or not, can in fact find entry points of empathy.
Yeah, no, I'm very fortunate in that I don't have a personal connection to it. I myself have never had an opioid use disorder. I there's no one, you know, that I know of that was close to me that did, or that got caught up in this rabbit hole of OxyContin addiction. My interest in it came purely from my outrage upon reading about it, that I could not believe that a pharma company run by a single family, that this company could be so deceptive, deceitful, dishonest, that they could just lie through their teeth to sell an addictive drug as non-addictive. And here's what really kind of set my hair on fire when I was sort of deep in my initial researching of it, was that our show dramatizes the 2007 case against Purdue Pharma that the U.S. attorney brought. Well, at the end of that, there is a settlement. There's a guilty plea by Purdue Pharma. This is all historical record. And so what does Purdue Pharma do after this guilty plea? Do they reformulate the drug right away? Are they contrite? Do they change their marketing? No, they sell even harder. They become even more aggressive. They act as if this was just a speed bump, that this was just a fine. This was just the price of doing business. And we are going to try and make even more money. And then they tripled their sales within 2 years. So to me, that is, I think, if there's no proof of pathology of you know, this being just one of the great crimes committed on this country, I don't know what is. So it really came from outrage, and then a hope that maybe a dramatization of what happened. And in the last two episodes, we dive into therapies of how to treat opioid use disorder that are highly stigmatized, but are actually really helpful. And there's it's very difficult for lots of people to get access to these drugs, buprenorphine, Suboxone. And so to shine a light on these drugs as a helpful path forward, I thought, well, this show could also maybe do some good too. If it could get more people into treatment, and even if it's not Suboxone, right? If it's just some sort of treatment that perhaps they weren't taking before because they have a better understanding of what they're afflicted with or what their loved ones are afflicted with, I thought, oh, well, maybe this can actually do some good too, besides me just being really, really angry.
Speaking of projects that you have created around, I just, you know, we were talking earlier before we got started about Recount, your piece about the 2000 election recount, where you actually spoke with a class of mine at Princeton many, many, many years ago. Sarah Palin's vice presidential run. Now this piece, what is next for you as a big story that you're hoping to tackle?
I'm not so sure yet. I've got a few different things I'm toying with, and I usually don't like to talk about stuff until it feels actually real. And right now they're all just kind of thoughts and sketches.
Well, we will be watching and waiting. And in the meantime, we'll be watching Dope Sick. Danny Strong is the creator, director, and showrunner of the limited series Dope Sick, which is out now on Hulu. I know, because I stayed up late to watch it. Thanks so much, Danny.
Thanks so much for having me. It was so great talking to you again.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And as we come to the end of today's show, we're going to shift gears a bit and bring you another installment of our Aging While Queer series. Now, according to a 2014 study by the Equal Rights Center, nearly half of all older same-sex couples have experienced discrimination when seeking housing. And many LGBTQ plus elders report experiencing discrimination and even harassment while searching for senior housing. And let's be clear, this discrimination can be deadly. Decades of research show that social isolation leads to negative mental and physical health outcomes among the elderly. And this is something Dr. Imani Woody understands well. Dr. Woody is herself an advocate for people of color, women, and the LGBTQ plus community, and was unable to find quality elder care for her father. She became passionate about helping those who are aging in marginalized communities. And that's when she decided to open Mary's House. We spoke to Dr. Woody, who started by explaining just what Mary's House is.
So it's Mary's House for older adults. We started with my dad taking ill and we having to put him in a facility. And it occurred to me, if he had been an out gay man, what would the treatment have been? Had he been an out trans person, what would the treatment have been? When, as a older adult cisgendered male, we put him in this facility continent and we pulled him out and he was incontinent. And so I wondered, in old age, it's so hard to be old and gay, really, those two, the intersectionality of aging and LGBTQ, SGL, same gender loving, can be horrific. And it shouldn't be in your golden years, right, Melissa? We should be able to enjoy ourselves, not worrying about how we are being perceived because of one of our intersectionalities. So Mary's House, the thought of it was born. I had my kitchen cabinet around, my pop died, left me the house. And I said, you know, what should we do with the house? The house is in Washington, D.C. And so we thought and came up with the idea, let's create housing, because across the nation, you know, there's a dearth of housing, affordable housing. I mean, if you're rich, you can live anywhere. If you're wealthy, you can live pretty much where you want. And so, but what do you do when you're just a regular Joe, Jane, Marquita? Where do you go? And so we said, let's build this housing. And that was the vision. And we're close.
I got to say, as I'm listening to you talk, I realize how much 10 or 15 years ago, this would have felt so abstract to me. And at that time, my parents were in their 60s and working. And, you know, like, you know, I certainly knew that they were aging, but I never thought much about it. But now I find myself fully in the middle of the sandwich, right? With, you know, yes, young kids on one hand and truly aging elderly parents on the other, and beginning to face all of those questions and realizing that when we talk about housing discrimination, when we talk about poverty so often, even though we don't say it, we're actually talking about young people, or we're talking about relatively young families. And as much as we think about many different intersections of invisibility, I'm realizing how much I haven't bothered to see how all of these questions are perhaps even more crucial for our seniors and for our older population.
Yes, I think that's true for many of us. I am older now, and I'm feeling the impact of aging and ageism, and I'm female. So it's hard. It's hard. And so I understand when you say you feel it. You know, it really comes to fruition when it comes in your backyard or becomes you. You really feel it, right? And so I understand that.
Now, I'm also interested in this, in the point that you make here about, on the one hand, when we do think about any of these questions, maybe we think about them in the context of poverty. But for older Americans, it's not necessarily about being poor. Ordinary folk, right? Folks who have been working class, middle class their whole lives. But once they are on fixed incomes and we see the cost of housing skyrocketing, for example, as it has in the post-COVID era, or we experience the realities of gentrification, having truly safe and supportive housing for those with marginal identities gets harder and harder. So talk to me about what it means, at least to you and to Mary's house, when you say safe and supportive LGBTQ plus elder housing.
Okay, so when I say safe and affordable housing for LGBTQ, same gender loving folks, I mean that you can put the key in the door and you're welcome. You can bring your whole self, W-H-O-L-E, self into the frame. That's your old self. No one's going to be condescending. We do a lot of that with our elders. No one's going to talk down to you. So you can bring your old self. You can bring your ethnic self, your Black self, your Jewish self. It means that you can bring all layers of you to a place and you won't feel any way. Like Melissa, you know, there's some kind of way folks can make other folks feel and you can't put your finger on it. And you're trying to figure out, well, is that because I'm old? Is that because I'm lesbian? Is that because I'm trans? Is that because I'm poor? You know, you're trying to figure out where affordable housing, in my opinion, your castle, where you lay your head and sleep and shut out the rest of the world, embraces you, envelops you, affirms you.
Which I suppose is what we all want from home, from the place that we call home, right? That when you walk in, you can bring your whole self. It doesn't have to be cute. You can, you know, it can be all the things
often
that
it's
it
not.
Is. It is often not, right? Your feet are allowed to stink in your own house.
Oh, your house, right? You can do those things. That's correct. Yes.
So talk to me a little bit about the education and training that goes into creating affirming housing.
My PhD is in human services, nonprofit management, and I'm building housing. So that's first. I didn't know what I didn't know until I was in the belly of the beast. It's not for the faint of heart. It's for if you have a passion. Because in many instances, affordable housing doesn't make a lot of money. You folks are with Mary's House for Older Adults. We're not going to get rich with this. It's going to we are. It's going to sustain itself, but we're not going to get rich. And we had to figure out how that sustainability would happen in terms of having, when we say affordable, which can run the gamut of 30% of your income to, let's say, $2,000 a month or $3,000 a month for a studio. The education, I would think a passion. It would be great to have. But what we do have, we have a incredible board of advisors, consultants, people in the community, experts in construction, experts in program management, experts in fundraising, experts in development. So the organization needs the education to develop it, as the individual needs a passion and a persistence to move forward and get to the finish line.
Tell me about the Golden Girls Bill.
Awesome. So the Golden Girls Bill is being proposed in Washington, D.C. City Council by Council Member Robert White. And the Golden Girls Bill is a bill that will allow elders to take in other elders in their home to rent a space in their home. And it will be a process wherein the elder, who the homeowner, can receive some funds and resources, and the renter will receive funds and or resources. But the bottom line is that they're going to be together. So we're going to kind of nip social isolation in the bud, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to create families. This, and Mary's House for Older Adults really loves this bill because we are creating families. Our vision, like you may know, that there are maybe 8 to 12 of these units for affirming LGBTQ SGL folks. But ours is the only, Mary's House is the only one that is offering communal living, building of families. And so the Golden Girls bill will build on that. It will build family and community.
You know, nothing could make more clear how important that is than COVID-19. My own mother lives, half a mile, not even from me, walking, you know, walkable, you know, bike riding distance. But during COVID-19, especially during those early months before we were really clear how it was passed and sort of how effective masking would be or any of that, I just didn't see my mother for months. And she lives alone. And never was it clearer that there's a reason why for most of human history we have lived together in community, because something like that happens and suddenly you need to be in your pod together in your Golden Girls house.
Yes, exactly. You need to be in your pod together. And the pandemic was really an eye opener. It really did open our eyes to how our elders are perceived. I mean, do you remember, Melissa, when some politicians were saying, oh, folks, take one for the team, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's still ethical concerns out there. If it's me and it's a 25-year-old who needs the ventilator, somebody's got to make that decision. And if there's only one. So there's ethics, who decides who lives, who dies, you know? So there's a lot of things going on when we talk about elders and they being perceived as throwaway people. And if you add LGBTQ SGL on top of that and add old on top of that, it's pretty sad.
What would it take to get a Mary's House in every community, in every neighborhood?
Oh, that question warms my heart, Melissa, because that's what we're thinking. We want to have a Mary's House in Washington, D.C. is our first one, and it's our first independent living residence. Our vision is to have independent living, assisted living, and hospice so that we have a continuum of care for this population. And we want it in every city. And it won't cost as much as the one we're building now, because we want to have donated homes. If it's a 4-bedroom home, then it can be a 4-bedroom Mary's House with a little upgrading so that it's communal friendly. So we want to have one in every city and country. Actually, Melissa, we were interviewed by some Russian folks who came over and wanted to hear about Mary's House. A French reporter came to us and wanted to know about it. Some folks in Germany wanted to learn about Mary's House. So we see this communal living project for elders, LGBTQ elders in particular, across all over the world.
Look at how your love for your father, your reflection on the realities of these intersectional identities just might change the way that seniors live all around the world. Dr. Imani Woody, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we have for y'all today. Thanks again for tuning in. And as always, call us with your show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or always send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back, because we'll be here again tomorrow.